fabulous. My man is here. I see him pop in. If you need a moment, Alex, take it. All right, he needs a moment. I'm going to give him that moment. Yeah, Trump has implemented additional tariffs. He's implementing additional tariffs. And we will all suffer for those tariffs.
No, not tariffs. Alex, the light.
You love tariffs. You think tariffs are great. When my drug bill goes up, I don't think they're great. How you doing, man? You doing okay today?
I'm doing incredibly well. Thank you, Jamal.
Good. I'm glad you're doing well. And just to give the bio, I want to make sure the audience knows who you are. Alex Craner. Why can't I give you a bio? There it is. Alex Craner. He's founder of Craner Analytics and creator of iSystems Trends Following. He has worked as market analyst, researcher, trader, hedge fund manager since 1996. He has authored several books, including Mastering Uncertainty in Commodities Trading, The Grand Deception, and Alex Craner's Trend Following Bible. Alex, I'm glad that you're here. I'm glad you are the person that I really want to talk to today.
Good to be with you, Jamal.
You once told me that Donald Trump is trying to crash the U.S. economy and he's doing it on purpose. Now, whether on purpose or not, I have spoken to other economists and all of you guys are in different, let's say, modes of thinking on either Trump and the economy. And yet you guys are saying something very similar in the sense that, A, the crypto thing creates a massive amount of uncertainty, kind of like the bubble back in 2006, 2007. That went belly up in regards to the housing mortgage, what is it, mortgage-backed securities, that it's doing that directly with the Treasury. Someone else will point out that there's all sorts of economic issues that are associated with the U.S., where there's a depreciation of the dollar. The depreciation is only going to get worse with the dropping of interest rates. And that there is no way we're ever going to be able to pay back what's going to end up being $40 trillion in a year. And so, meaning, you guys are saying different things, but you're singing from the same hymn book in regards to this idea that the U.S. economy is about to take a hit. And I think yours is interesting because you point out they're about to take a hit purposefully.
So maybe I didn't explain myself correctly, Jamal. I didn't say that he was going to crash the U.S. economy.
The dollar.
I thought that they might crash the U.S. dollar.
Okay.
Okay.
Is there a difference between those things?
Oh, yes, there's a huge difference between those things because the dollar is just, you know, one of the things that circulates in U.S. economy. You know, you need to maintain production of food, production of, everyday needs, apparel, communications, fuel, energy, all of these things need to be produced and they will be exchanged against something. It doesn't have to be the U.S. dollar. Now, the reason why I think that they might do that deliberately are actually a few, but one of them is that's a way to default on your debt, to pay them back in worthless dollars, because there's no way you're paying back $40 trillion of public debt, and that's to say nothing of the other types of debt, you know, the private debt by households, by companies, by banks, and so forth. You arrive north of $110 trillion, which probably works out to more than $500,000 per taxpayer. Jesus. An impossible sum. And all the money that's in circulation today, so we're talking about the monetary base. People can look it up on a Federal Reserve education something, Fred, the website is called Fred. I now forget what it stands for. But FR is for Federal Reserve. So the monetary base arrives at around $6 trillion. So
in the United States depends upon the honor system.
I'm sorry, Alex. Please continue. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so you have $6 trillion as all the money available to service total debt that amount to more than $110 trillion. That's almost 20 times, okay? So it's simply an impossible situation. And typically governments in those circumstances, to prevent the system from seizing up and collapsing very rapidly, they keep flooding the system with liquidity. so that the economy can carry on, so that, you know, people continue going to work, that there's gas at the pumps, that there's medicines at the pharmacy, that there's food on the shelves and so forth. And, you know, everybody loses their savings insofar as they are denominated in U.S. dollars. But, you know, you don't get situations like the Great Depression, that, you know, you have millions of people who die of starvation. Another reason to crash the dollar is, and I actually worked this out pretty late, I would say even maybe a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. One of the most puzzling aspects of global events to me is the power of the United Kingdom. I couldn't work out, why is Britain so powerful? Their economy is in the dumpster. Their fiscal situation is absolutely catastrophic. So as an economy, they're losing ground rapidly. They have no significant army to speak of. Their navy is Lilliputian. Why are they everywhere? Why are they involved in everything everywhere around the world? Why are dozens of governments around the world signing all kinds of cooperation agreements with them, military defense pact and all of this? How is it even possible that they're playing such an important role? And I could see that they act through proxy forces, you know, which are not just foreign proxy armies and governments, but also their own very, very extensive network of intelligence, non-government organizations, private contractors, charitable organizations. You know, they're all linked to British foreign policy in one way or another.
Yeah.
But they, in and of themselves, they have the appearance of being some private do-gooder organization that is always there to help. And they always go to help to places like Somalia and Syria and Lebanon and Myanmar and Yemen, where then, you know, their help is followed by rivers of blood flowing and everything going belly up. And okay, so, you know, you realize how they work, but this is hugely extensive. So how is it, where's it getting the funding? Where's the money coming from? And it turns out, it seems to me that way, it turns out that they control the whole Eurodollar market, or most of it. And I listened to an interview with Alistair MacLeod recently. He's a very, very well-regarded market analyst and a former banker, so he's a reliable source of information as far as I'm concerned. And he said that the size of the Eurodollar market is $10 trillion. So I just told you that the monetary base, the whole, you know, all the dollars in circulation within the United States are about $6 trillion. Eurodollars is about $10 trillion. And that's not circulating in the United States, and it's not necessarily under control of the American government. It's largely under control of the City of London. And most of that money is in the City of London and their associated banks, and in the offshore centers like, you know, British Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands, Cyprus, and so forth. So it seems to me that this is how they manage to stick their dirty fingers into everybody's business everywhere around the world. They have a huge hoard of money with which to make things happen, bribe corrupt politicians, fund their NGOs and charities and intelligence operations and so forth. That's the source of their power. Now, how do you deal with that? You know, how do you disarm them? I think the only way to disarm them is to crash the dollar market completely, to crash the U.S. dollar. That's when they, you know, their weaponized use of euro dollars can be collapsed. So, you know, you kill two birds with one stone. You collapse the power of Great Britain, and you pay off your debts with worthless paper. And then, you obviously need to introduce a new currency, a new monetary system. And I think that's why Trump has Scott Bessent on his side, because, you know, he and Steve Miron that's their domain of expertise. But then, you know, hopefully they will also be discussing these things with the Russians, because the Russians have been pondering this problem for a great long time. And I think that they have some solutions they can propose.
Well, the reason I even brought you on in part was because of something that the Russians said. An advisor to Vladimir Putin pointed out that the United States was effectively trying to turn to crypto and move over to crypto with the idea of effectively getting rid of its debt by leveraging other countries around the world to do so. Meaning, the moment that they turn into a cryptocurrency, they can manipulate the market in a way that depreciates the value of the dollar that makes it impossible to pay it off. Now, mind you, this damages other countries. And even from the standpoint of the United States, I don't know how other countries would even trust it. Give me a take on that. What do you think the response of other countries is going to be?
I think that this is entirely possible. And the thing that really, really makes sense for the United States is to maybe you leave the external dollars be. You leave them as they are. But the domestic circulation, you reset it to a different basis. So maybe you adopt a crypto standard for the domestic circulation, because in this way you insulate the American economy from external shocks, which could happen as an unintended thing and an unintended crisis. Or it can happen as an intentional attack. Again, you know, if somebody outside of the United States controls $10 trillion worth of U.S. dollar circulation, well, you know, they have a gun to the head of the American government. So this system is how China in the late 1990s, in 1997, avoided the East Asian financial crisis, because it was a massive financial crisis in 1997 that engulfed all of the East Asian economies except for China. And the way China skated is because they had dual circulation. They have one currency system for foreign trade and investments, and they have a different circulation for domestic use. And so their domestic markets were protected. And I think that Trump and his government will probably attempt to do the same thing. Now, what happens to the foreign holders of the US dollar? They're going to lose, obviously. But, you know, American people didn't elect Trump to worry about foreign holders of American bonds. They elected him to take care of their domestic affairs primarily. And if he does that, then, you know, good for the United States. Everybody else, you know, I don't work as a hedge fund manager anymore. But, you know, always as an investor, sorry.
You're fine.
As an investor, you're responsible for the performance of your investments. So if you load it up on U.S. debt, you assume the risk that they will collapse. That's a possibility always. You have to take that into account. So that's, you know, that's not for, you know, obviously there's going to be consequences and repercussions. But it's not like today the credibility of American government is this shining, unblemished blessing,
right,
that everybody takes to the bank without any, you know, U.S. government has broken absolutely every treaty they ever signed with the Native Americans, right? They routinely break treaties and agreements with foreign governments. So there's no loss in damaging U.S. credibility there. You know, it's already shit. Sorry.
You're fine. Yeah, you're fine.
It's already shit. So, you know, what's the loss there? There's nothing much to lose on that side.
But I have to say, though, if country, this is not like a surprise nuclear strike. Like, meaning it's not like, you know, Trump shakes the hand of a guy, turns around, and then they bomb a country. And I'm using that allegory because that's effectively what it's going to be to the economy of the world. And I would wager to the U.S. This will be a systemic process that people can see coming. And in seeing it coming, aren't those countries that are just going to immediately dump dollars? Like, meaning they're not just going to be like, we are just going to stand here and hold the bag as the United States goes through with this process. It is going to hit us. I don't buy the premise that it's not going to hit us.
Well, we will see how it will hit you, but something's going to hit you anyway. It's not like if Trump continued the policies, the economic policies of Biden and Obama and Clinton and so forth, that everything would be swell and everyone would live happily ever after. The system was already on an unsustainable path long before Trump ever came near the White House. Mm-hmm. So something has got to be changed, and there's got to be that cathartic moment when, you know, you unmoor the system from the from where it's anchored now, and then you're going to go through a bumpy period of transition. But that has to be done. It's not like you can just, you know, snap your finger and everything will be better without there ever being any kind of a crisis, any kind of a, you know, some people are going to lose in the process, some people are going to gain in the process. But the people who have been gaining like gangsters for decades now are the people sitting in Wall Street. Do we need to protect that system? And they've been splurging their largesse on the military industrial complex, on the big agriculture, on the big tech, on the big ag, on all of these industry cartels that were milking the American economy and the American people for decades upon decades upon decades. Do we need to protect the system that coddles them and gives them all these privileges? And then when, you know, when excrement hits the fan, they go like, well, let's go to war now.
Mm-hmm. But do you think they will be in the best position in order to take advantage of that system, of that changeover? Or who do you
Who is in the best position?
The same people from Wall Street, meaning people of means. If I'm Elon Musk and I have, I don't know, $1 trillion at this point, am I in a better position to take advantage of it? If I'm Zuckerberg, if I'm Bezos, add any rando oligarch you want to add into it. Like, I guess what I'm asking is, who is in the best position to take advantage of that changeover?
Well, look, the more wealth you own, the better your position. That's obvious. But that doesn't mean that they're going to take advantage of that position, because usually people of privilege concentrate on trying to preserve that privilege. They're not going to stop and say, this is going to change. This is not going to continue this way. So maybe we're going to, you know, leave these old type businesses behind, and I'm not going to run Amazon anymore. I'm going to develop a chain of mom and pop stores and support local small and medium sized businesses around the country. They're probably not going to do that. Let's say if Trump ends up implementing policies that I think he will implement, it's going to be to the advantage of ordinary people, ordinary entrepreneurs, small and medium sized businesses, because that's the only way you lift the United States back out of its crisis. Small and medium-sized enterprise in virtually all countries are the main driver of employment. Like, they create something like 70% of all employment in all economies. They're the engine of innovation. They're the engine of foreign trade, but they need, you know, they need protective barriers. You know, they need tariffs to protect them from foreign competition. And so that has to be done. And that's obviously going to be one of these bumpy discontinuities that are going to cause an uncomfortable transition. It may take a generation for all of this to crystallize to something. You know, it may take 20 years. But nevertheless, it has to be done. If you want to bring industries back home, you're going to be able to bring some of these large industries in the space of a few years. You know, car assembly plants and, aircraft, you know, big businesses. But the small and medium-sized enterprise, they have to, you know, they have to come from the ground up, which means that many of them are going to start from scratch. And hopefully they will have credit available to them at favorable terms. You know, secure long-term credit. Not like today where, you know, the bank gives you credit when you don't need it. Then when you need it, they yank it away and they cause mass bankruptcies. And so you have a lot of businesses that could be successful, but for the banking system. And that has to change.
But Trump is only going to be in power for 3 years. The next president, and I'm telling you what's going to happen. When people feel economic pain and they see the country in a recession, which we will go into a recession as he goes about this, they will change horses and they would do it in a heartbeat. It's like we even have a saying, it's the economy, stupid. It's the economy, stupid. We don't care about the wars. We don't care about murdering people abroad. When it comes to he's making us poor. I give an example, the farmers. Donald Trump has decimated the farming industry in the United States with his tariffs. When people are paying more for drug costs, which are already astronomical in the United States, you really think that they're going to sign on to this process of self-immiseration? With an administration that is causing that immiseration and ride that boat out for 20 years. We don't make long-term plans in the U.S.
But why do you say that Donald Trump decimated the farming industry? Was it doing well before he came to the White House eight months ago?
Well, even in the first term, if you remember, Donald Trump passed sanctions against China, and passing sanctions against China, you lost the market of 1.4 billion people, in which case that market evaporate, in which case the farmers are now out there praying for God to help them out. Like literally, I can show you the video of them praying to Jesus for help. Trump, if I'm not mistaken, in the first term had to actually give them effectively welfare in order to keep them afloat. And he's probably going to have to do something similar this time around. So, yes.
Jamal. Farming has been under attack for decades now. And it's under attack in Europe as well. And Trump is not the president in Europe. I mean, you know, I see it around me. You've seen protests in Germany, in Holland, in Britain. Farmers are pressed to the edge of existence. They're one of the cohorts with highest rate of suicide in Germany, in France. In Croatia, they're slaughtering livestock by the tens of thousands under whatever pretext. This is not Trump. This is Agenda 2030. You know, you can't lay everything on in front of Trump's feet. We have to be a bit more rigorous about the way we analyze things that are going on. And it can't be Trump on everything. There's you know, if we misidentify the cause and we misdiagnose the crisis, we're not going to solve it.
Alex, that goes for both of us. I agree with you. But I'm not laying everything at Trump's feet. I'm pointing out that the farming industry in the U.S. took a direct hit. Farmers were not on welfare before Donald Trump passed sanctions, in which case China responded by their counter sanctions. And they targeted Trump's base, which was the farming communities in places like Iowa, et cetera. That's not everything. That's something very specific that I'm bringing up. I mean, I don't know your situation.
Well, just to be fair. You know, American farming is... The American farming has been distorted. Well, I don't know if distorted is the right word, but it has been misguided for many decades now. American farmers are people who produce mountains of corn, soybean, wheat, oats, sugar, basically cash crops. They ride on $2 million John Deere tractors as they scroll on the internet, and they grow monocultures, you know, like whole country, a small country size of soybeans.
Yes.
And then you need to sell them to China because, you know, you're not going to sell it to consumers, right?
Yes.
So the whole farming sector has to be reformed so that, you know, when you talk about farmers, you're not talking about ConAgra and how do you call it? Monsanto and people like that. Of course, these people have money to pay actors to pretend to be desperate farmers and cry for cameras. So people say, oh, Trump is attacking the farmers. He's attacking ConAgra. He's attacking Monsanto. He's attacking these giants that live on government subsidies. And of course, the actual farmers, the ones that actually sit in those tractors, they end up getting crumbs off the table. But we're talking about multinational corporations. That's who the farmers are in the United States. Transition to diversified family farming, where you have, you know, a bit of wheat and a bit of oats and some vegetables and fruits and pigs and chickens and eggs, all produced in a healthy way on healthy land without toxic chemicals. That's not going to happen overnight. That's also, and, you know, if I were Trump, I would be attacking the current system of food production, because not only is it wasteful and harvests these mountains of cash crop monocultures that need to be dumped on the world, they're strengthening the hand of the big ag, and they're making people unhealthy, and they're being environmentally horrible. They're destroying the land as well. And then obviously there's going to be some farmers who have bought into this and who have, you know, who are this deep in debt because they had to buy those John Deere $2 million tractors. Well, they are going to cry. But what do? You continue growing millions of tons of soybeans?
No, I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry. I was just agreeing with you. I do get it. Like, I get your point that any changeover is going to require, quote unquote, a changeover. And look, sugar is subsidized in this country. I mean, there's a reason.
So are soybeans. So is rice. You know. And nobody cares. Nobody cares. That's not socialism. You know, if government gives money to big corporations, awesome. If government gives money to ordinary people, socialism, communism, death, let's hang them all.
Okay, fair enough. I understand your point. I, by the way, what do you think this is going to look like for the rest of the world? I mean, let's say, I strongly suspect that countries are going to start offloading dollars the moment that they see the U.S. move in a particular direction. The U.S. is not this indispensable nation in the way that we see ourselves. We're not this Allen fortress. I mean, that was made clear when the United States tried to do a tariff war across the world and many countries told the U.S. to F off. What do you think happens in the material world when this changeover takes place, if he does indeed try to go to cryptocurrency, if he does indeed try to, let's say, leverage the rest of the world in order to pay down the deficit? How do you think they respond, and what do you think they do?
There's going to be a transition. You know, they're going to have to adapt. Fortunately, today we have alternatives, which is, you know, BRICS, Belt and Road Initiative. We have Shanghai Cooperation Organization as a security, you know, building a security architecture for the world, or at least for the Eurasian landmass. And there's going to be losers. There's going to be big losers in this whole transition. And because, you know, since World War II, pretty much, commodity exporting countries, oil exporting nations, and you know, all others, they have been selling their commodities for U.S. dollars. They have accumulated large reserves of U.S. dollars at the Federal Reserve Bank. Yes. They got caught in that system. And they have been coerced into that system, you know, by British and American diplomacy and foreign policy apparatus. They enjoyed it because they were able to buy, you know, fancy yachts and apartments in New York City and the south of France and in London and Geneva and so forth. But they are going to have to be weaned off of that system, and they're going to have to develop their economies in a different way. And I think that largely this is already being done. You know, many nations are making this transition. They are increasingly trading with other countries in their own currencies, meaning they're no longer accumulating large U.S. dollar sums at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. They are joining the BRICS organization. They are trading with China in Chinese currency. Mm-hmm. And as a collective, you know, the BRICS nations, they might come up with their own trade settlement currency and their own reserve currency. Or, you know, I don't know in what form that's going to be done yet and when. But that's an alternative. You know, maybe before, well, I don't know, maybe 30, 40 years ago, there was no alternative. Everything was West-centric. So you know, if you didn't want to be a closed-off autarky like North Korea, you had to, you know, enter that matrix. You had to trade in U.S. dollars or euros or pounds. You had to do what was necessary not to be sanctioned and embargoed. And so that's the reality that everybody pretty much got caught with, and we're still caught in that, and they're still trying to preserve that system, and they're still attacking the population, trying to rip every last shred of their sovereignty. They're destroying food production particularly in Europe, and yeah, it's going to be a crisis period, but it's not like if everything remained as is, mm-hmm. that everything would be wonderful, because it's not wonderful. I mean, you know, we already had the experience with the pandemic and them wanting to introduce the digital IDs and them wanting to, you know, introduce this draconian censorship and CBDCs and, you know, measuring our individual carbon footprint on for everything we do, subjecting us to biannual booster shots and all this, you know, this was not a bright future for us. So yeah. I, you know, we're going to have to go through a bumpy period of transition, but I welcome that, because otherwise, you know, you can look forward to a future that's possibly worse than just death.
Let's dig into that part for a bit. What do you see if there's no changeover? Like, you know, regardless of what you believe Donald Trump is trying to do and what the way and the direction that he's pushing, if nothing changed, what do you see
taking place? Well, if there's no changeover, then I see decay and revolution. Because, you know, people are already on the verge of a revolt. And I'll give you an example about how deep the discontent goes. I was just in Croatia recently, mm-hmm. and there's this insane scheme, and I swear Trump's not behind it, where they're bringing in migrants from Nepal, from India, from the Philippines, and the government is subsidizing businesses in Croatia to hire these immigrants. The government is giving them 600 euros per person per month to hire them. And these immigrants work for an average of 800 euros a month, while the average salary in Croatia is, I think, about 1,000 something, maybe 1,300. I don't know exactly, but something in that neighborhood. So if you're a business, thanks to these government subsidies, you can hire a Nepalese, pay him 800 euros per month, of which the government gives you 600. So you practically get a slave for like a token amount of 200 euros per month.
Yeah.
And that's the job that's yanked from under a native-born Croatian person because those subsidies are not available to Croatian people. So if you want to hire a Croat, you have to pay him the full salary plus everything, you know. So you end up, he ends up costing you about 2,000 euros per month on average salary. Whereas you get a Nepalese for 200. That is a shocking treason. And people see it. Okay. While at the same time, they're destroying our agricultural production. And this same thing is going on in Italy, in Germany, in Belgium, in Spain, in France, everywhere. And I'm telling you, there's going to be some triggering event where people are just going to overthrow the governments, particularly because in Europe, they're not allowing us to even have elections. Or if, you know, like if we like a candidate that wants to change things, then, you know, they use lawfare or bullets or whatever else to make sure we can't vote for that candidate. We have to vote for some loser who is on the globalist side. But this happened in Slovakia and Romania and France and Germany. They had seven candidates of the AfD party in Rhineland-Westphalia who like dropped dead in the space of 2 weeks before the elections. You know, people are seeing this. And the grievances are run very deep, and something's going to happen. I don't know what. You can't predict these events, but you know, otherwise they're just taking us down the road to serfdom and slavery. And you know, I'm at a point where I don't necessarily want my children to continue living here if nothing changes. And so, you know, people will leave or they will have to rise up and overthrow the governments as they are now. So that means that we also get a transition, but it might be even bumpier than in the United States. And then, you know, thankfully, again, there's the alternative. And I think that we're going to be able to transition to realigning our political, economic, social development to these multipolar integrations, to BRICS. So it's not necessarily going to be chaos, everybody going to war against everybody, revolutions, beheadings, guillotines in town squares, and so forth.
It's like King Louis just takes it, takes the hell.